Welcome to the Tao of Color Grading interview series, where we talk with influencers, thought leaders, and professionals about the field of color grading for moving images. Show notes, links, our free weekly newsletter, and our color training products can be found at taoofcolorgrading.com. And I'm your host, Patrick Inhofer. Welcome to part two of our interview with Edmonton-based colorist Joe Owens, owner and operator of Presto Digital Color Grade. You can also find him on Apple's support forum for color, where he's the lead helper. He has over 30 years' experience in our industry, where he started as a camera shader. Let's just jump right back in where we left off.
And so now, where do you work now?
I have my own facility, Presto Digital in Edmonton.
Okay, and you're working off of what kind of gear?
It's all Apple at the moment, mm-hmm. and I have been considering the Blackmagic Resolve. Coming from a DaVinci background, I really appreciate the tool set. I haven't been convinced yet in my market. Nobody's asked for it, and I'm pretty happy with Apple Color.
Right.
And I don't honestly think that it's the software that they're interested in.
Right. Yeah, well, they're interested in you and your eye and what's between your ears.
Yeah, they honestly don't care how it's done.
Now, you were an early adopter of Final Touch 2K.
Yep.
This was before Apple bought it. It was Final Touch. The 2K version, I'm sure you know the number, is what was about $20,000?
A little more than that.
A little more than that. And then there was a yearly support contract.
Yeah, which eventually kind of got me into Apple Color, not quite as painfully.
Right. So that there was a little relief there. What was your initial reaction when that happened?
Well, this happens to people who buy software all the time.
But, you know, not everyone buys $25,000 piece.
Yeah. Well, actually, they do. I've personally never owned an Avid.
Right. Well, Avid. Well, Smoke now. I mean, you know, you could have bought a Smoke for $160,000 18 months ago, and now all of a sudden the Mac user can get it for, you know,
$15,000. Yeah. Yeah. Media Composer 5.
Right.
$1,500 or something like
right.
that. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, this is the trend. And certainly I didn't get stung for as much as some people have. And to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure whether I could have bought that kind of much advertising with that amount of money,
right.
as all of a sudden there was this gigantic awareness of grading,
yeah.
and it was deeply mysterious. And I think we have this is a point to get into this discussion as to it being a kind of a closed, mysterious, yes, and one of those dark arts,
yep.
that people don't know that much about it. Color grading is not so much taught as absorbed.
Right.
You can learn software. You know, you can turn knobs and buttons, and I've watched a lot of people grapple with it, and I've trained people. And there are folks who want to give it a go, and they really try hard for a couple of days, and then they just say, no, I can't do this.
Right.
Or some people just suddenly the bulb comes on, and they're away.
Colorists have traditionally been known as very insular. Very, you know, you've got people who they consider their techniques to be proprietary, maybe the certain filter they always like using.
Yeah, I certainly have encountered people who have a signature look. And I honestly think that every colorist has a thumbprint.
Hmm.
And sometimes if you're looking at a piece, you want to say, I'll bet you so-and-so did that.
Right.
9 times out of 10, if you actually know them and you've watched enough of their work, you're right.
Right. Do you have a colorist that you like someone whose work that you look at and maybe in the feature world or something like that, who, you know, you hear like he graded a film and it kind of makes you want to go
and go see that, see what they did?
Yeah.
The people who work at some of the A-list, there's a guy named Doyle who's done all the Harry Potter and
right.
those kinds of things. Highly stylized, and they have a real unique sense and style and feel to them. You know, there are superstar colorists out there like Bob Festa, who's
right.
been working commercials forever. And if you have watched TV, you have seen his work.
Right.
And who else says Stu Mashewitz,
yeah.
You know, these guys have pioneered some signature looks. And for better or for worse, you know, teal and orange is with us.
Exactly. Yep.
There's a couple of guys that I worked with directly. And I think, you know, I was profoundly affected by two guys back in Toronto, VTR days, Ernie Moser and Kim Krauss. Now, Kim is on the Creative Cow every once in a while. He's in South Africa now. And those guys, they did a lot of music videos and things, and they were working early days with that System 60 XL corporate and doing things with it and exploring, you know, where to go with it. And very often, you know, they were, you know, being stick handled by commercial users to do certain things, but they always found a way to add a little dash to it, you know, that was theirs. And if you've got a good relationship with your agency type or whoever, then that's what gets you back, is that little Tabasco in the sauce.
I mean, literally, I mean, I heard days, I mean, especially in the early days of MTV when music videos were all the rage and digital video effects was pretty much, you know, to do anything interesting, you kind of had to think outside the box. Telecine guys putting, you know, pantyhose over, you know, the lens, or maybe you work with some Vaseline, or you do all sorts of kind of little interesting things literally within the gear itself in the analog space.
Yeah. I made a lot of money with a 1/8 Hampshire.
A 1/8 Hampshire?
Yeah. It's basically a cinematographer's diffusion for lighting.
Okay.
But it's, tell you, a little goes a long way in the gate in a telecine.
Right.
And so very, very mild diffusion can get you amazing effects. And so, yeah, I went through that whole cheesecloth and fishnets and stuff like that. I went to a curtain finishing place and got a ton of extra samples from them and put all of them in the telecine and figured out which ones,
you know, which ones worked and which ones
which
didn't.
Which ones didn't. Almost none of them worked.
Almost like a fly fisherman, right? You had your little pouch of fabrics that worked for you.
That's right. But you never ever introduced a foreign substance like Vaseline into and, you know, I have heard stories about doing that kind of stuff. And, you know, we also unrolled, you know, we'd do a banker's pass on a piece of film, and then you go roll it down the hall.
A banker's pass?
Well, yeah, transfer it clean. Uh-huh. Put it in the bank so that you've got a pristine version of it, and then unroll it and roll it down the hall and walk on it.
Oh man, that I get a little heebie-jeebies thinking about that.
yeah. Well, that's why we did the banker's pass first, and then you get some real interesting effects at the back end of that.
Do you find yourself struggling to maybe create some of those looks again digitally now that you can't roll out the tape? You can't. There's no transfer process to.
But there's a guy named Graham Natras.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's got a genius vault of tricks that I have no hesitation pulling down from. Right. From time to time,
right.
And I see it on a lot of timelines, even that come to me, and I leave those in.
Okay. And now, do you go to third party plugs? I mean, you know, you make your career working in Apple Color, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where you make your money. But when you're pulling out of that, are you just handing the rendered files over to people, or will you sit down on the timeline? Will you be thinking in color? You know, I think I'm going to use that. I might go back to that Gram plugin, or I might pull out Magic Bullet Looks or whatever it might be. You might have some favorite little tweaks that you can't get in an Apple Color and you know you're going to go back to those?
It's about maybe 50-50.
Yeah.
Very often, editors already made those decisions.
Right.
And I exist mostly as a service. And so I do what's necessary, what's asked of me. And if I can add a little bit of flavor and make a suggestion that there's an enhancement, then I'll pull that in. And whatever trick works is... You know, I'm mercenary in that. That's the polite way of saying it. Whatever works, and whatever plugin or, you know, Sapphire or Magic Bullet or anything that's what they're looking for, that's what I try and give them. Very often, because of the ability to move things around value-wise, sometimes the plug-in works and sometimes it doesn't in terms of what kind of values it needs to operate to generate the optimal effect, where you're going with it. And I'd say maybe, like I say, when I'm in a 50-50 situation, 50% of the time a preset will work, and in the other 50% of the time I'll have to build one, because it's just outside of where that operation is to get that amount of diffusion or something. Right. So I need to crank it up, or I need to, when you crank it up, the exposure changes, and then you start into this spiral of one effect defeats the other, and so you have to offset it and precondition it so that it does do what you want it to do. And that can get time consuming, especially we're in a hardware situation now where it's just fast enough to lure you into trying to do it, but just slow enough that it's going to take you a bit of time for the system to settle down and show you what it is that you have set it up to do. Occasionally I've gone out of a grade to come back to it and go, what the heck is that? And no, it hadn't finished settling down before I left.
Yeah, I've seen that happen too, where you bounce back into a grade and you're like, what the heck is going on here? What did I do wrong? And then, a second later, it snaps it all together. You have to toggle it, go jump a frame.
That especially if you've got something going on in the color FX room.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll take a while before it snaps in and goes, that's what it's supposed to be. Where was my diffusion? There it is.
Yeah, exactly.
For me, I'm utterly pragmatic about the tool that I use. I don't care what it is that I employ, as long as what comes out of the screen is what my intention was and what gets me clients coming back through the door. Mm. And people interested in coming into the door to see what it is that I'm doing, and how those people are walking out with smiles on their faces, got what it is that they were happy with on the screen. Like I say, I'm interested in resolve, and certainly the amount of cash that we put out, that 20 or 30 grand, is still nothing compared to some of the big iron applications that are still out there for, 5, 6, 7 times that.
Yeah.
Luster, base light, you name it.
Scratch. In fact, I have, it's interesting. And one of the reasons I find this interesting is because obviously Resolve is following the same path. And I actually, so now you can buy Resolve for $1,000, another $15.
Well, the software.
Yeah, the software. And then you need to buy some new cards if you're a color user. Mm-hmm. But, by the time you're done, $3,000 and you're good to go. What happens is
not even the price of a good monitor.
It's not. You're going to spend more on the monitor than the software, yeah. And I've actually had a Scratch reseller tell me about Resolve, Resolve is a toy. I mean, no one can do great work on, it's past its prime. It's, no one can do a real film and a real grade on Resolve.
I did have a conversation a couple of weeks ago with someone who has a lot of notoriety in color science. And they did talk about the amount of basic internal math that these applications offer. And there is a degree of difference between, Apple Color and the three-way within Final Cut and Resolve and Luster and Base Light and some of the Speed Grade and a few of those other. And it really is a kind of model where, what do you need it to do? At what level? Where is this property being aimed at? And if it is for an international distribution in an A-list, cinema, theater experience like Harry Potter, where the budget is in the tens or hundreds of millions, you want absolutely the last degree of control over every pixel.
Right.
And I don't think you need that for cooking shows.
Right.
And I'll say that softly.
Yeah.
A great deal of what is being shown on network gets seen once, twice, three times, depending what the distribution windows are. And we have limited budgets. And so, it's, you know, this is basically a TV series that goes 8-13 episodes. It's not $100 million, no.
Right.
And the turnaround, you know, this, at the beginning of the Apple Color Final Cut integration, there was a lot of chat about, well, how well integrated is it? Can you just send it out and send it back? You know, how long does it take? How long does it take to render? What kinds of tools do you have available to you? For what it does and the amount of time that we have to turn them around in, I would have to say that a couple of years ago, 3-4 years ago, I would not have taken on the kinds of jobs that I'm doing now. Hmm. Because I was used to a tape-to-tape environment where you come in, you grade the thing, you go through it once, twice, you know, do a refine pass, might do spot check here and there, play it out to tape. You're all done same day, you know, half hour, 1 hour episode of something or other. Right. And I'm turning out 22 minute episodes overnight now, where I will take 3-4 hours to run through the prep for making the export out to color, making sure that the color project is
sound.
Intact. Sound, yes. And then work through it. And set it to render, go away, have lunch. It's quick enough now. They have improved the render engine. I was kind of timing things and thinking, no, you know what? It wasn't doing this 4 years ago.
Right.
And the new GPUs are faster, you know, more cores or whatever. And so, yeah, it is taking on more of those characteristics, and just in terms of logistics. And finding that, maybe even that same evening or in the morning, because that's my turnaround. I just come in, hit the export button back to Final Cut, check it, make sure there's, you know, no rendering defects and that sort of thing, lingering filters, whatever, that got stuck in the XML round trip, take those out and dismount the drive, send it.
Do you ever find that, you know, you render it out and then you take a look at it and you're like, yeah, I don't know what I was thinking, and you have to go back and fix it?
Not so much anymore. I think that's an experiential thing, in that you eventually, over the years that you do grading, become more and more internally consistent. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you go, whoa, okay, something happened there.
Right.
And the series I'm working on now, I occasionally have those wah moments and go, oh, it's one of those filters that got stuck again, go into the filters column, delete it, and go, ah, yes, you know, it's
right.
Not exactly, I was mistaken once, but I only thought I was.
Right.
But, it's not, over a period of time, you build up your internal consistency, and you do get questions sometimes where you just went off the page as to maybe the scene is consistent, but no, we don't want it to be that way. We need it to be another way.
And will you have typically work with a client in the room, or are you usually on your own?
At the moment, I'm usually on my own. Mm-hmm. And that has changed significantly since I have my own facility. Used to be clients were very attentive when I was an employee in a larger firm. And I don't know, because the rates haven't changed that much.
Right.
Because there's no account exec in between. they know I want to get through it as quick as I can.
And, unlike the account exec who wants to shake hands and establish a, you know, a relationship.
Yeah, and as long as this can go, that's good for me.
Right.
but anyway, that's not always the reason. We do need to be efficient about, you know, getting projects through. And they also know that it's my personal, you know, reputation that's at stake. That it's, delivering that product. It's they entrusted with me. Say, we wanted to get it there. But
if a new client walks in, someone you've never worked with, mm-hmm. do you prefer to get them in with you for a couple hours?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any other way of working.
Okay.
You really have to get a read on where that person's priorities are.
And that's done just simply, let's pick some hero shots and let's start working through it, and you get their feedback. And then at what point are you kind of, all right, I know what they want, and you just kind of go and they're checking their email?
Yeah, you can sort of test that in session.
Yeah.
In that you find your hero shots, and then you go to something else, and you walk through a couple of scenarios, and you'll have three or four targets in the back of your mind, and you go, I wonder which one he's going to go for.
Right.
And if it's the one you guessed...
You guys are on the same page.
Yeah. Right. And if it's not, then you reevaluate your position and you test it again.
Right. So those first few hours are really, really important. That's where you understand what they want to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And you find out what's important to between you.
Right.
And establishing that rapport. And if things go off the rails in future, how you fix those mistakes. I mean, these are just... business practices, really. And it doesn't matter whether you're selling insurance or real estate or encyclopedias or brushes, bottles, mouthwash.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And now most of your clients, are they local to you then? I mean, you were saying, I think, you know, before we started, before I started recording, you were mentioning that, you know, the next closest post facility is like, you know, a day away, you know?
Yeah.
So are most of your clients local to you? They're shooting and posting and finishing all locally?
Yeah, people in my community keep me pretty busy.
Right.
But it's not a huge market, and it's nice to attract people from outside the market, and it also keeps things fresh. So you're not seeing the same faces all the time and doing the same things, because people have different approaches and they have different tastes and different styles. That's what I really liked when there was a lot more money out there, because people were moving around a lot more and trying different things and experimenting. And people aren't as eager to risk, you know, throwing some money someplace. And, you know, if it sticks, great. And if it doesn't, we'll just spend more money and go someplace else.
Right.
Don't really have that luxury in these days.
Right.
And, however, people are looking for excellence for exactly the same reason,
right.
And they'll go a distance to find it.
So you're serving a clientele who cares about picture, who's looking for excellence. So how do you build your room? How's your room kind of laid out and built out to help you, you know, the pipeline you use and things like that?
I have basically what is a one-bedroom apartment in a completely renovated heritage building in downtown Edmonton. It's in the Chinatown district. And the person who owns the building tore it right down to the girders 8 years ago and rebuilt it up to 21st century standards. Hardwood floors, granite counters.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a three-story building. First story is all retail, second story is all residential, and third story was all blend. Commercial and residential. And there were actually people who had sublet the space that I'm in prior to my taking it over. And it has a sunroom with a skylight that's my office.
Nice.
And it's nice to go in there and depressurize.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Get some sunshine. Other than the actual business end of the room is essentially a living area, which has a combined kitchen with an island. So it's a full... wet bar in some in some cases, and
so you know, an agency person kind of feels like they're walking into an upscale place,
yeah.
And yeah, so they can still feel like you may not be pampering them with all the little cutie girls running around, but at least they feel like they're in a nice environment that they can relax.
Well, not that the muffin girl is not important,
right?
I saw that work,
right. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah,
and you know, client creature comforts are seriously, if you don't pay attention to them, it won't be a problem for long.
Right. Right.
It will cure. It will fix itself.
Right. Yeah. You just won't have anyone coming in.
Right.
Yeah.
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 It's important to have a completely calibrated environment that the client feels that what I'm seeing is what I'm getting.
Right.
So that has to be verified. Those things have to be on the numbers.
What kind of monitor do you use?
I'm using an eCinema DCM23,
okay,
which was sort of the state of the art in 2004 when I was looking for things.
Right.
I'm not 100% sure whether I'd stay with that or not. There are a lot of things competitive on the market for less dollars, but as far as replacement goes, I'm in no hurry, that's
right,
for sure.
Right.
Certainly, things have changed utterly in the last 4 or 5 years, and I probably would be able to set the place up for fewer dollars than I actually did, because so many things have changed price. High-speed storage, for instance. I went and bought a 1.5 terabyte hard drive yesterday for $50. $50.
1.5 terabytes, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, it's nothing to stuff a Mac Pro with 6 terabytes now.
Yeah,
and then when you fill it up, just take them out and put 3 more in.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Now, do you use? Do you archive? Do your clients require archiving services from you?
Not necessarily. No. Okay. A lot of times, most of my stuff goes out to tape, and that becomes the
archive.
The only digital archive medium that will have a predictable lifespan.
Right.
Yeah, I watched a project blow up a couple of days in another facility that people were searching the premises frantically. Hmm. And I did not want to be in that position. Luckily, I'm kind of one of those service situations where, you know, the drive comes in, the drive goes out, it's their drive.
Right.
You know, that's up to them to archive it.
Right.
But it's a serious problem.
Yeah. Rooms. You know, I mentioned earlier I did an interview with Alexis Van Herkman, and we spent 20 minutes just talking about the characteristics of a good color grading room. The one thing we didn't talk about that I always find kind of interesting is the relationship, the literal physical relationship between you and your client. You know, some rooms you've got the client behind you set up on a desk. That's a very business-like environment. Others put the couch in front of you, and you've got a plasma, big plasma, mm-hmm, or a big projector you're looking at. As a colorist, have you had opportunity to work in a lot of different setups, and do you have a preference as to where you want your client to be for maximum interaction and the best experience?
Well, when I'm working alone, of course, I plant myself.
Right.
And, it kind of doesn't really matter. It's basically a question of neck strain and that sort of thing, as to making sure you got a good eye line,
right,
so that you aren't, that third or fourth cervical vertebrae doesn't eventually break down.
Right.
That pain in the neck. And I know people who are even just Final Cut editors get it.
Yeah. I mean, in the old linear rooms is a huge problem, where you put the monitor above, you know, sitting above your program, you know, above your interface.
Yeah.
And you're just looking up all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But really, the big issue is to keep distractions away from the screen where you're looking, and judging color, of course, keeping other bright lights or bright colors away from it. You know, working in a position where there's a big Avid system parked right next to it, and it has a default orange, like an orange stoplight menu screen, and I have them shut that off.
Right.
Well, it'd be like trying to judge cologne in a room where they kept dousing you with rose water or something.
Right.
Anyway, there are other better examples, maybe tasting beer,
right,
where they give you a shot of tequila in between. Yeah, that's not going to work. Although it'd be a lot of fun.
It would be.
But with clients, cheek by jowl works for me.
Meaning sitting right next to them?
Right next to each
other. So you like them coming right up to the desk and just hanging out right next to you.
Yeah. And if they're a really savvy customer, I like to almost get them involved in the controls.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
And they really take ownership at that point.
What control surface are you using?
At the moment in my big studio, I have 3 Tangent 200s.
Oh, nice.
You know, the ball knob transport and key. I didn't go for the S panel.
Right.
I can do a lot of clicking and dragging for $6,000. But I also own a Tangent Wave that I use to if I've got a satellite operation going, or if I carry it with me into somebody else's facility, which is, you know, kind of fun too. If a place is set up to be more internal, they want to keep things in-house, and they don't necessarily want, for whatever reason, non-disclosure agreements to take a project out of house into somebody else's studio, there's a little control issue there. And it's not necessarily, you know, micromanagement. It's just like, no, the client does not want this to leave the premises. So you come in, you set up your Tangent Wave, you plug in USB, everybody's got the software. It just works.
Right.
You know, they're happy with their monitor. That's their, that they're using that judgment. They set it up. If everybody's happy.
So you're not, I mean, if it's in the middle of a red room, you're happy to just sit down and say, you know.
That's the circumstances that they are happy with.
Right.
I'm not happy with it. And I say, okay, you know, if this room is red, then we're going to have to adjust the lighting because.
Right. I need to not see the red.
Yeah, we can't be doing that because everything in this room, and people don't understand that from a really basic outset, is that everything in the room affects what you see.
But if that's how they judge all of their content, and all of their content's running through this room, and it's always a red room, you're like, well, I mean, you know, I'll be consistent with everything else that they do, at least, you know.
And if that's one of the two or three precepts of color correction, color grading, consistency is one of the, you know, legs on that milk stool that the whole thing sits on.
What would be the other two?
The person operating the software itself, and the grading environment in which you're doing it. That basically is what you have. Those are the, if there were three main components to setting up, trying to do this in a consistent and professional way, that's what you need.
Yeah, those are the basics.
Yeah.
And I guess I think we can probably start wrapping up the interview. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, everybody loves being interviewed because we all have an opinion, right?
That's exactly right. I'm more than happy to let you express it. Talk a little bit just about the impact of desktop grading on you and your career. I mean, you've worked those million-dollar rooms.
Totally liberating.
Yeah.
Having control in some respect. Over my own hours, although that I'm losing control of it because of demand.
Right.
And working a lot of hours and putting in, you know, longer days than I ever have. But taking ownership of it, you know, and getting a certain profile, establishing a presence, you know, being able to express an opinion like this.
Right.
You can be a staff person, and I actually had this chat a couple of years ago with someone who was talking about, quote, my clients, and maybe I was overstating the case, but they aren't actually your clients until they write your name on the check.
If you move and they move with you, then maybe
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, that happens a lot, you know, where somebody wants a better, they negotiate a better situation.
Yeah.
And that used to happen because we couldn't afford the hardware.
Right.
You know, and if you wanted a better situation at another location, you convinced your clients to move there and you went with them, or you went there and you took your clients with them. And, man, I've heard stories about, you know, confrontations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right in the suite.
Yeah.
Yeah. You do this, we work now, we do this like this, or we go.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes a bluff is called and sometimes it isn't. And most of the time it's not a bluff.
If you kind of imagined yourself getting into the market today, I mean, because really we just talked for 10 grand, you could put together a pretty good grading suite.
Pretty good.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Right. What do you think? What's the biggest challenge you think? I mean, obviously, besides finding clients, in terms of the craft, you know, what are the biggest hurdles that someone has to overcome in terms of being good at the craft and the fact that they're isolated, they don't really have a community around them or people that they can go to? Because you had a lot of that.
That isn't necessarily craft related. It's business related, you know, as to how you, this is just almost 100% setting up a small business, even if it was a corner confectionery. as to how business is conducted. And I did a crash MBA. You know, studying a lot of what people wrote about in terms of how you make sales,
right,
how you interact with customers. And I was always struck by one person's take on doing business as that it was all a social interaction, and that the article that a person bought, paid for, was more or less almost just a souvenir of the social engagement. And you know, that certainly applies to the product that that particular person was producing. But if you think of all human interaction as a social function, and what we're doing in terms of storytelling is to getting on the same page, then that whole thing is a process of negotiation between individuals doing that storytelling. And the whole thing, and it surprises me that the function of, you know, colorist is seen as insular and you know, closed, because that's really where the penny drops. When I go out on set and see all these people, you know, scurrying around, you know, doing lighting and electrics and doing greenskeeping and setting up effects and, you know, acting and directing and moving tapes and, you know, there's, you know, it's, was it Michael Ondaatje's Conversations with Walter Murch talked about English Patient was the first time he had ever visited a set, and he said it was like going back in time to the court of Louis XIV, because there was this highly structured environment where all these people had this, you know, codified, you know, set of assignments which they did, and there was this hierarchy of so and so was allowed near the camera, and no, you don't go there, you don't go there, you don't stand this, you don't do this, you do that, and all those kinds of things. It's, you know, it's more orchestrated than a Formula One pit stop. And I thought, you know, all these people are laboring away and put this picture on this drive or this tape or this film, and all comes to me.
Right.
It goes through the editor, fine. There's this whole editorial thing going on. But eventually, it goes through a few people's hands. And then I started thinking about what the actors are doing. You know, is putting it into the camera. And everybody does a performance. It's all a performance for me. And you bring something to the party. You add your own spice, your own take on things. And, you know, if somebody is really good at narration or acting or directing, that they are able to position things, or they are able to bring a line off the page, then they bring life into it. If you can bring a little bit more, you know, life into the picture, you add that something that just, you know, carries through to some viewers' enjoyment, and they get an emotional experience about it. My daughter, learning the craft here in musical theater, told me something a couple of months ago, where she was in class and the instructor was saying, "I don't care what you're feeling, you're carrying what the audience is feeling."
Right.
They need to feel something.
Right.
And think, okay, so, you know, everybody has a role to play, even if it's way back in some dark room. If it goes through your hands, you're responsible for that performance.
And that's in the end. I mean, that's, you look at the major players who really have an impact on performance and how the audience views it, mm-hmm. then you have an impact on the emotional effect of it.
But mostly it's a fear of failure.
Well, mostly it's a fear of failure. Yeah, no kidding. It is, isn't it?
Color grading is a bizarre field in that it's not almost something that you choose. It in some ways chooses you.
Right.
And you do something somewhere and it starts, there's a nucleus. It's almost like a drop of rain falling, you know, that condensate of water up there that, you know, it finds a particle of dust to glom onto, and by the time it hits the ground, it's, you know, it's a fully formed raindrop or snowflake or whatever.
Let me see if there's anything else here I wanted to get to.
Yeah, I worked in a room where there was client behind, and people didn't recognize me. I would have to turn around.
They know you by the back of your head, right?
That's right.
Well, have you talked to people who put their clients in front of them?
I was playing around with that concept myself.
Yeah.
And It's hard.
Yeah.
I know it's kind of like a hangover from Rush's days.
Right.
When the producers and directors and whoever, cinematographers would sit and watch the Rushes projected.
Right.
And so maybe the film timer would sit with them and make notes, you know, 2 points of blue, 3 points of red, blah, blah, blah. It might be a hearkening back to those days. And right now, the way my suite is set up, the 23-inch monitor, we turn around and work over the equipment and the scopes and stuff like that. But I do have an 11-foot projector that we turn around and watch because I don't want the two monitors to be in the same line of sight.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, because it's always the concept, you don't want two color monitors in the same room.
No.
Because the worst situation you can be in is a client looking at one and saying,
I like that.
I like that one. Make the other one look like that one.
It's just 4 weeks ago, I was in somebody else's suite who had that setup. And sure enough.
Do you think a plasma is acceptable as a grading monitor?
They require a lot of supervision, but I know a lot of places are putting them in because that's, you know, it's apparently bigger is better. If you set back far enough, maybe you can achieve a good enough fusion that you know, it'll work. But I know a lot of them have a lot of internal processing going on that you need to have control over. Go into those menus and shut off all that stuff that's
automatic gain control and black level control.
Yeah, and aperture control, and it makes it sharper, does something with the field rate, or it's, you know, line doubling or doing some crazy thing. When you're in grade, you need the unvarnished truth.
Right.
Otherwise, you're just aiming at some target that whoever assembled the set in whatever country it was assembled in, you know, on their coffee break while they were, you know, they were in a rush to go for coffee or bathroom break or whatever it was, that they didn't quite set it up the way it was supposed to be.
Well, Joe, I think we kind of hit all the major points I wanted to hit. Thank you very much for coming in. I greatly appreciate it. And it's great seeing you again here in New York City. And thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
That's our wrap with Joe. You can find Joe on Apple's color support page or at Presto Digital Color Grade, where he's the owner operator. If you enjoyed this podcast, take a moment. Leave feedback on iTunes. It really helps other people find this resource. On the Tao of Color website, there's extensive links to what we talked about in this episode. You can also sign up for a free weekly color grading newsletter and a unique paid training program where I walk you through color grading a 14-minute film shot on a Canon 5D using three different workflows. Thanks for listening.